This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to the Urban Political. Your hosts today, my colleague Ross Beveridge.
Hello, Marcus. Hello, everyone.
And myself, Marcus Kipp. Our puzzle for today's episode is: how can we think about film and filmmaking as urban research or activism? To explore this question, we have three guests with us, all of them urban researchers and filmmakers. Please do check out the show notes for more information about our guests, their fabulous films, and other relevant resources. I'm going to very briefly introduce them to you in the alphabetical order of their first names. Nitin Bhatla is an architect, artist, and academic currently doing a PhD at ETH Zurich. He co-produced the film Not Just Roads together with Clerios Eduardo Papanicolaou. Sandra Jasper is a filmmaker and a junior professor of geography at the Humboldt University of Berlin. And she collaborated with Matthew Gandy in the production of the film Natura Urbana, The Brachen of Berlin. And Tino Buchholz, an urban sociologist and filmmaker with a PhD from the University of Groningen. And his most recent film is entitled How Poles Became White. In 2011, Tino's debut was the film Creativity and the Capitalist City, The Struggle for Affordable Housing in Amsterdam. Throughout this following conversation, you will hear after each round of questions, short bits of the amazing soundtracks of the respective films of our guests. And now let's get right into this. Nitin, Sandra, and Tino, how did each of you get into film? Beginning with you, Nitin.
Hello, hi. Thanks, Marcus, and thanks, Ross, for the invitation. So I would like to think of film as something that's immersive. It allows you to take the audience with you in the field, and it allows to share this privilege of being in places that you are with the spectators or with the audience, transforming them into ethnographers or researchers as well. I was particularly struck by David Madden's review of the film The Pruitt Ego Myth, in which he talks about how films like Pruitt Ego Myth are needed not just to defog our thinking on housing, poverty, and urban change, but also to speak to the emotional aspects of urban change. And I think the film kind of does that. So my journey into filmmaking was a mixture of chance and kind of also goodwill. So I had this ambition while starting my PhD to use videography for my sort of field research. And in conjunction to this, I sort of took a course at ETH, which was around ethnographic filmmaking, particularly with sort of focus on cities. And through that, I met Clerios Papanicolaou, with whom I have sort of made this first film that I just put out. And it was through meeting Clerios, who was actually a filmmaker, that I sort of was able to kind of understand and develop sort of sensitivity towards cinema and towards filmmaking, and understand this complex process, but also sort of appreciate it. So that's how I sort of got into this world.
Thank you, Nitin. Sandra, do you want to continue?
Yes, of course. While my journey into film has been long and short at the same time, I had an indirect journey into film because my oldest and best friend is a screenwriter. And because of her, I have quite a large network of film friends, but I never really thought about making a film myself or being involved in filmmaking myself until I started my PhD at the UCL Urban Lab, a kind of interdisciplinary center in London, which I'm sure most urban political listeners might be familiar with. And the UCL Urban Lab has a specific interest in film. So one of the first films I saw there when I started my PhD was Of Time and the City, a film about Liverpool. And for my PhD project, which is about or was about West Berlin, I watched very many films about the so-called island city and got really interested in filmic representations of urban space. And then the active filmmaking started after my PhD. And that journey was, as I said, pretty straightforward because Matthew Gandy, who's professor of geography at the University of Cambridge and director of the documentary film I will be talking about today, received an ERC advanced grant for a project called Rethinking Urban Nature. And he asked me to join his team as a postdoctoral researcher and also as co-author and co-producer of the film Natura Urbana, The Brachen of Berlin, which is the first film I was kind of actively involved in.
Thank you, Sandra. Tino?
My initial moment was somewhat of a side effect of my Amsterdam chapter, part of my PhD, my Amsterdam chapter in 2009, when my friend Benjamin Bischoff, who's a professional cameraman, he asked me, like, what are you doing there in Amsterdam? And I was basically telling about this historical situation of the squatting ban that was about to come after these 3 decades of civil squatting as this routine procedure every Sunday, like people in need of housing would meet help themselves with direct action. It was a very civilized context. No violence, no conflict really. This was a very interesting constellation and situation. And of course, I told him, yes, please join me. Let's see if the camera doesn't disturb anything, but is accepted and adds to it. Let's simply do it. And ever since, he provides me with the self-confidence of a filmmaker. Without him, I have not made a film so far. So and I love his photography and really picked up to think in pictures to see the value, the added value to the story. And this opening scene of this civil squatting action of our film is definitely the pearl of the film, and I wouldn't want to miss it. And engage with him and film ever since.
Okay, thanks for that. Going a little bit deeper now, so touching on the differences between making films and writing, which all of you do as academics, what are the differences between the two forms? What can film do that writing cannot, specifically in relation to thinking about urban life and politics? And we'll start with Neeting again.
Thanks, Ross. I think that's a very important question, particularly reflecting on what Sandra and Tina just said. I think there are two things mainly. Firstly, I think a film over a text has a sort of observational potential as compared to a narrative potential of a text. You can invite the viewers and immerse them sensorially into the diegetic world of the film, and they can make meaning for themselves. So you don't need to over-contextualize something in a film. You don't need to narrate anything at all, but rather the protagonist and the sort of human and non-human actors sort of speak for themselves in a way in a film. And it's sort of transformatory in many ways. But I think also to touch upon a film as a web of competencies or web of collaborations, multidisciplinary collaborations, basically. I think it is important to acknowledge that as a researcher, you cannot make a film by yourself. So you need editors, you need producers, you need very competent people doing graphics, doing coloring, who are able to work on sound as a part of the project. And I think Sandra wrote a beautiful paper about it, where she sort of talks about these collaborations that exist in a film, both in front and behind the camera. I think what is important to highlight here is that it's not an arithmetic coming together of these different competencies, but rather it's a mutually constitutive relationship. So in the film that I made with Kleros, it was very formative in how he was sort of editing, or how he was looking at the material, and how he was looking at the sound, and so the visual material and the oral material from the field. It was very formative in how I was also researching while I was in the field. So I think it's transformatory in both these ways, for the viewers and for you as a researcher as well.
Thanks, Nitin. Sandra?
Yes, thank you, Nitin. I think you mentioned already several points that I also had on my list. So I'm just going to kind of add to that, because I also agree the point of film being a kind of teamwork project, a collaboration project, both with the people and protagonists in front of the camera, but also with this kind of larger team, from color coding to sound design to editing behind the camera. Although there's also kind of new possibilities now, filmmaking, which is also a very costly undertaking to do that, is also with new technologies getting easier to make with smaller teams and on a lower budget. But we can come to that also later on. But I think in relation to writing, to me, the biggest difference is that kind of, for me, and it's difficult to describe it really, but the audiovisual language is somehow a different kind of language, like trying to represent and work with cities through moving image and sound. You create a certain rhythm, a temporality in film by editing, obviously, as well. And you can't always anticipate how audiences will react to this, which is probably different from a more kind of standard academic or scientific paper. And what I also really enjoyed about the specific project I did with Matthew Gandhi was bringing in different angles of the city, kind of different angles, different scales, different perspectives, from close-ups of urban surfaces and insects and plants, to shots from vantage points like bridges or rooftops, and also bringing in different temporalities of the cities. A city you can work with time-lapse, night and day, or the seasons. When we filmed in the summer, although it was raining almost every day, you don't really see that, because you can use specific methods to kind of change the color of images, obviously, as we mentioned. But you can also bring in historical change through archival footage and kind of different mixing different sources as well, old films that you can bring in into a documentary film. And I think the other key point, or there's two more points I want to make briefly about the difference. Another point for me in terms of the specific topic of Brachen or wastelands in Berlin is that in a way the documentary film we made is becoming an archive in itself, because by documenting the city and by filming spaces that are in transformation, you also create a kind of urban archive for later on. And the wastelands that we filmed in 2015 now have all disappeared, which speaks to the kind of pace of change in Berlin at the moment. So it's kind of now a document of what the city looked like in 2015. And the last point I want to make is about film and audiences, which I think is an important point. That with film you can reach different audiences beyond the paywalled scientific paper. I'm not talking about kind of maybe more accessible books, but definitely in terms of film as a tool of research, you definitely have the chance to meet people at film festivals, but also show the films to schools, to university students, in community centers, at theaters. So you reach very different audiences and you get very different reflections and reactions to the film as well.
Thank you, Sandra, for those reflections. And Tino, how would you frame this, the differences between film and writing in relation to the city?
Well, I don't like to think of this as a difference. Like, I think it should be possible to do both. Go for the match of both. I mean, my cameraman once confronted me with this statement. Are you sure that this is not a written essay but a filmic one? And I basically told him, yes, I am. I mean, the process of writing, like, just like with music is written, film is written, and also text is certainly composed. And I mean, my first film had 6,000 words, the second one 9,000, roughly. And while it should be clear, like that there's an added dimension of all the, yeah, all the gestures, all the sounds, like all this situation, the smiles, the sighs, the deep breath somebody takes. I mean, all this contributes to the atmosphere, like that would require like an extra dimension and so many words like to describe it, and it would often be left aside, like because there's no space for such. And but with film there is, and if we only, yeah, I mean, my latest film is on a subject, let's say melancholy and struggle is the bottom line. It's it's a very tempting subject. Like, how do you express this? How do you capture this? How do you make it strong? With essayistic film, this is certainly possible. I have approached it as such, and I'm convinced that this is the right medium. Like, while I would struggle to write this down and to make it hard, hard facts. I mean, talking about the explicit interest of science and the implicitness of a filmic essay. And but also with the first film, like we talk about a vacancy, like how property guardians are guarding a vacant space. They are treated as if they were not there. Of course, like you can put it like this, and you have a picture in mind how this might look, but with film, then again, Yeah, it is obvious, and you go on that journey, and it affects you differently. So I wouldn't speak of a contrast, but of a complementary relation that can be very beneficial.
Thanks, Tino.
You're hearing the title track of Not Just Roads.
Let's talk a little bit more about perhaps the filmmakers who've inspired you all, and the way you you work yourselves in film. Which filmmakers have best captured the urban politically, in your opinion? And how have you yourselves tried to capture the urban in your films? So start with you again, Neeton.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Ross. And I would like to agree with Sandra and Tino both that there's perhaps a huge diversity in sort of the kind of films that are coming out of urban studies as it is constructed, because it's sort of coming together of so many disciplines from geography to ethnography. And I would say, like, there's quite a few films that are inspiring that have come out in the recent times, and I would like to say about the Pruitt Ego Myth again by Chad Friedrichs, and of course Natura Urbana by Matthew Gandhi and Sandra Jasper, but also films like Push that came out last year and or 2 years ago rather, that was quite transformatory in sort of creating a real debate. But I would say the film that kind of inspires my way of seeing films or my way of approaching films is perhaps Behemoth by Zhao Liang. One might say that it's okay, it's not a film that is very directly urban or about urban politics or urban studies, but it's a kind of, it tries to disentangle sort of politics of extraction in Inner Mongolia and China. And its intersections with sort of this non-city urbanization. So you have these condominium towers coming up in really near to extractive landscapes in Inner Mongolia. You have all kinds of labor exploitations happening there. And the film sort of tries to capture in a very sort of observational way the entanglements and perhaps the intersections between these divergent strands, so to say. So it's sort of very contemporary in capturing processes of extended urbanization. And I think that's sort of a segue into the film that I did with Claire Huss as well, in which we are not directly dealing with a city in particular or a city space as well. It's sort of a very... It's about a project called Bharatmala by the government of India, through which they're building 23 kilometers of new highway every day. And that's unbelievable because that pace didn't even exist under the Marshall Plan. So it's sort of a very outwardly a project to create a new urban land, to produce new urban land. But it is also a very contested project because you have... other forms of inhabitation that exist in the territory. So it's not a terra nullius. It's really something that is very inhabited by sedentary and non-sedentary actors and human and non-human actors. So in the film, we try to speak about this big project through talking about one highway in particular close to Delhi. In which you have a very diverse range of actors. You have nomadic pastoralists who are talking about almost erasure of commons. So like a very extensive enclosure of commons. You have machines. So we sort of try to tell the story of the highway through the machines that construct them. And we try to tell them through the life inside the condominiums that are coming up. So like these gated condominiums, so we immerse the viewer in that. So it's sort of, in the film, we try to somehow stitch a spiral or a puzzle in which every viewer kind of tries to can create a very relativized and a very personalized story rather than a narrativized one.
Thank you, Nitin. Sandra?
Okay, yeah, I think this could really, I tried to keep it short because this could really turn into this film nerd conversation for my end, because there's so many good examples and so many interesting films. And for listeners who are interested in seeing maybe some lists of films or potential films to watch, as I mentioned earlier, the UCL Urban Lab has a film website with recommendations about films set in an urban context about cities. So I can recommend going to that website as well. And for me, I mentioned the film Of Time and the City by Terence Davis. And that film was an inspiration in the sense that it worked with archival material. So that is something we also did for Natura Urbana. And I really like this possibility now to go back to older films and work with the layering of different kind of film footages. And you get these very different textures of film, from kind of early reel films to video. And it's often sometimes for Natura Urbana, it was quite difficult to integrate these different formats into a contemporary film. But I find this really fascinating, how these kind of different film technologies evolved over time and how they also influence the kind of texture of films and how they come across visually. And because I'm researching on my doorstep at the moment, due to the corona pandemic, I've started to, rather than going far away abroad somewhere, to research some wastelands around my kind of new office in Adlershof at the Department of Geography. I found a wasteland that's now being developed into a commercial zone. And that wasteland was part of a film studio of the 1920s, the Jofa Studios. Now, a recent book refers to the studio as the Forgotten Dream Factory. And I really found this history of these of the studio interesting, because there were really kind of very political left-wing films were produced there. For example, Coole Wampe oder Wem gehört die Welt, a film by Zlatan Dudov, depicting working class lives in industrial Berlin. So I'm kind of going back in time for my inspirations at the moment. And I like this kind of relationship between physical actual places in Berlin and then the history of film in relation to the city as well.
Thank you, Sandra. And Tino, so how about you? What filmmakers for you best captured the urban in a kind of political way, and how has that kind of inspired your own work?
Yeah, I need to say, like, I'm also not going to make the list too much longer, dropping too many names, but two individuals that have inspired me, my Inura mates, Lorenzo Tripodi and Mark Saunders. Lorenzo working in this collective Ogino Knaus, Florence, Berlin, they are based. And they are exploring urban worlds in Cuba, Russia, Italy, And having this situationist take on, an essayistic kind of framework. While Mark Saunders, for example, delivered this film, The Truth Lies in Rostock, Rostock, Lichtenhagen, north of Germany, after the reunification in 92, where the German mob gathered, united against the other, which were Vietnamese guest workers at the Sonnenblum high-rise building, and eventually setting it on fire, and 3,000 people around, clapping hands, police watching. I mean, this was the new German reality at that point, and he captured that on film. Very impressive, tragic and impressive at the same time. But I mean, this is what a documentary film can be about. And this kind of impressed me a lot. And my own take is on conflict. It's on conflict and movement, which I share with these two, always with a reference to open conflict. But like in my latest, open conflict. Actually, open conflict was not so much the case in both of my works, since the creativity and the capitalist city, it was this civil issue, and the conflict was long solved. In the 80s, there were the clashes between squatters and the police, and so forth. From 85 on, this always was this civilized issue, when there were eviction rounds and the water cannon was simply drawing rounds, but the squatters were long gone and they had squatted anew. And this is how it went till 2010. And but also with how Poles became white, with the bottom line of melancholy and struggle, I'm searching for internal, of the internalization of conflict, and self-limitations, that do not lead to open conflict, but that lead to endless struggle, to multiple struggles in daily life, multiple jobs, multiple obligations, so many moments where there's where it's more about sheer exhaustion, but not exactly a moment to rebel. Against what you could so many times say, and our protagonist also makes this point, talking about capitalism while dishwashing, for example. And how do you trace it? How do you trace the limits of resistance, of rebellion? This is what we try to do, what I try to do, and this is the essence of this latest film, How Poles Became White.
And this is music from Natura Urbana, the Brachen of Berlin. Filmmaking, in my understanding, is also always an act of constructing reality. And I wonder what kind of politics and ethics do you see involved in issues of representing cities, places, people, and certain practices. So, and I also would be interested in hearing from you how you have dealt with such issues in your films.
So I would perhaps talk about how I did it in my film, which I initially assumed would be quite a short project, but it ended up being a project that spanned 2 years. And I was shooting in the field basically for a large part of that time. That was because somehow I think the representation in the film, it requires a lot of time being spent with the protagonist. So I returned with quite a few protagonists again and again. And I tried to understand what was at stake or what was the contestation about and what was really happening, rather than taking an idea with me and trying to find visuals and sounds that can fit it. So I think in terms of representation, a film should maybe allow everyday life of these protagonists to play out and allow them agency to sort of develop space in film develop their own representation in the film, rather than you instructing the protagonist to be in a certain place or behave in a certain way.
Thank you. Sandra, do you want to continue?
Yes, to follow up on what Nitin just said, I think I agree that this point about building trust and knowing the protagonist is really key and important. And in Natura Urbana, we were working mainly with other scientists. I think it was important in this film that especially Matthew Gandhi, the director, but also myself, we both knew these interviewees or protagonists quite well. And so we sort of had a shared understanding of what we would like to communicate in terms of the kind of ideas around wastelands, but also the ideas around kind of overlooked spaces in cities, the enthusiasm for plants at the side of the road, weeds, and kind of smaller minor ecologies, if you like. And so that was really key and important. And I think talking about the wastelands, we were also asked at a Q&A, I think, or at a commentary at some point, why we didn't include a map of all of these interesting spaces in Berlin in the film to kind of locate them and pinpoint where they actually are. And that gets to the point of the struggles around these spaces, which is quite important with regards to smaller plots of land, for example, and the visibility they get. So we decided against this. We have a list of street names trying to locate some of the sites, but also by drawing too much attention to certain spaces has this ambivalent history in Berlin of urban pioneering and questions of revitalization. So there's an ethics there of maybe not drawing too much attention, or not the wrong attention, to the overlooked, I think, which is an ethical question with regards to the topic of this specific film. And it's not, and I think there was a key point also in making the film straight away at the beginning of this 5-year research project. Because now the wastelands in Berlin were disappearing or are disappearing at a rapid speed. But we're also interviewing a particular generation of scientists with the main protagonist of the film, Herbert Zukop, who are telling us a specific story about the city, about the kind of aftermath of the Second World War. So this is also kind of the last generation who has experienced this transformation of the city and the Second World War and its aftermath. And that's also in a sense, kind of, I felt like a responsibility to give this generation a voice and have this particular perspective at this particular moment in time in the film.
Yeah, maybe I just continue. In terms of representation, of course, it's always interpretation. It's like not the truth, but a truth that we're talking about, and it's the subjective take. My film then in the end, like my take, I have the responsibility, how to present settings, characters, and the overall narrative and dramaturgy. My responsibility is, I have an imagined audience in mind. In my case, that will always be like a mix of academic, activist, art, not so popular in the end, as we also don't engage with voiceover or any other overly educational features. It has multiple layers, and much of it is also to be found between the lines. Given these ideal audiences, for our latest film, the ideal audiences would be not only academic activist art spectrum, but like Polish, Dutch, German, I'd say. The title, How Poles Became White, addresses the Polish situation, but it's not only a film about Poland. It's a film about whiteness, about the social, the making of a social order or a social hierarchy, a center, periphery, semi-periphery. This is how the discussion goes in Poland. But it's also about this shock therapy of the 90s, where I'd also rework my biography, because it's also shaped by that, coming from Eastern Germany, Northeastern Germany. And you have to demonstrate that you are aware of the context, of the sensitivities, protect your protagonists, at least do not betray them, do not set them up. This is the major no-go of a documentary film, I'd say. And exploring this social spatial hierarchy of black and white, searching for the shades of gray, looking east and west in Europe. So it's a very European film, I'd say, with a bigger message, connecting to other works, how Jews became white, how the Irish became white, this kind of stuff. What has ethnicity to do with that? Class is also racialized. In gender, we find this as well, and in the geography. So we're talking subjective limits and the political framework as such.
And now music from How Poles Became White.
So thinking, so reflecting back and looking forward a little bit, what difficulties have you encountered as filmmakers who are also academics and activists? And looking more to the future, how might film be better encouraged and recognized within academia, and so that it can be seen more widely as a form of research and activism?
So I would rather start this sort of question with a hopeful ecology that is emerging. And I think Sandra sort of mentioned about UCL Urban Lab early into this podcast. And I think that is a very interesting space and very important space that a lot of people who are cinephiles kind of try to access and kind of look out for new and upcoming filmmakers and researchers making films on urbanization, urban studies, built environment, architecture, etc. But there's like newer film festivals that have emerged across the world. So Urban Eye in Bucharest, and then there is also Urban Lens in India by IIHS. And these are drawing really great crowds, and sort of they are also inspiring a new generation of researchers to take up filmmaking as a research and storytelling tool. And I think that is quite hopeful. However, I think what's a major stumbling block, and I think Sandra might mention this more in detail later, because I'm sort of reading this out literally from her paper, which is about how do you sort of evaluate in tenure positions? How do you sort of, I mean, for example, in my PhD, I spent quite a considerable time working on this film with Clarus, of course. But it is not quantified at all for my PhD evaluation. It is something that is aside from the PhD, but not a part of my PhD. So I have to produce a classic monograph still. So it's it means that I've been working without weekends since quite some time, which is all right. That is academic life. But then can we think of ways of integrating sort of filmmaking into the curriculum or into how we evaluate academic work or how we appreciate academic work as well. I mean, my film, for example, would not be able to get as many citations as a 8,000, 9,000 word paper would. So what does that mean for my future career as well? That is, I think, something that keeps me up in the night.
Thank you, Nitin. Sandra, how would you reflect on your experiences and what might be positive steps moving forward?
Yeah. First of all, I want to follow up on appraising the Urban Eye Festival in Bucharest. I went there, I don't know, it's probably two years ago now. And it's an excellent, really well-organized festival with very lovely people and great audiences. And I can only recommend to follow what they're doing. And yes, I have a similar kind of perspective as Nitin does. It's tricky in a sense. On the one hand, I can't say too much, and Tino might be the best person to talk about this, about getting funding to do a film in the first place, because I was really lucky to be involved in Matthew Gandhi's ERC project, and there was funding allocated by the European Research Council for doing a documentary film, which is also quite rare. Other research councils wouldn't easily do that. So that really gave us the opportunity to work on a film for almost 2 years. And speaking of the 2 years, obviously that means spending a lot of time aside from the financial resources, paying the team, etc., spending a lot of time on filming and editing. So it's a very time-consuming endeavor, which is also a lot of fun, obviously. I would love to do it again, but it also means questioning this in this position of being in an academic context, working as a researcher and making films. If you do both, it can be really tricky. First of all, as Nitin said, on the PhD level, but then also when I worked on the film, I had just finished my PhD, and then I worked on this film for 2 years. So luckily, I have a job and I have kind of a great context to work in. But it's a tricky moment in time right after the PhD to devote a lot of time to a film. So for me, it worked out, but I was lucky in a sense, being involved in a bigger research project. So I think we need to kind of think about how film could be part of a method that's more acknowledged in urban research, filmmaking as a kind of, not only as a kind of methodological tool, but also as a kind of research output or research project, a collaborative project in itself, and how that kind of rubs with these kind of measurements of impact or measurements of publication citations, how people are evaluated in terms of their academic productivity. I think that raises a lot of more general questions about how that's done anyways, which is, as we all know, can be quite problematic. So I think, as Nitin said, also there's hope in the sense that we see these urban film festivals and institutions devoting kind of resources towards urban films, and also a forum like the AAG Review of Books doing a film review forum, and the kind of big kind of AAG conference has a short film section now. So stuff is happening, and at the same time, I think some of the tricky questions haven't been fully tackled. So yeah, more is to be done.
Thank you, Sandra. Tino, how was your take on these tricky questions?
Yeah, I fully agree to what's been said so far. It's more than tricky and very precarious. It asks much idealism and self-exploitation. Even though we managed to get some funding, it was in the first place always like own money, like to kick off the project. So you invest in a possibility. And later you find co-producers. In the first case, it was the University of Groningen that served as co-producer. Later, it was actually to former colleagues of mine who did appreciate the first film, and who served as co-producers plus a grant from outside, but there was still lots of own money that was also needed and invested, because you just raised the standard and the ambition. Also, not editing myself, not really engaging with the camera work myself, which would be necessary to do it. I know that Nitin does it, and he does a great job, even qua sound design. I was thrilled how he did that, but this would be necessary. I mean, of course, if we only think of the difference academic video or video as such, and then again documentary film, there's a qualitative difference in this, and it does take more recognition. I mean, also in terms of visibility and justification of research projects, like also justifying public money and stuff, like and reaching out to the public, to a wider audience. I mean, any bigger research project would deserve like some sort of a short film that kind of first serves as teaser and later maybe even as a longer piece, like that touches upon the core subject of that research project. It should be possible. It would be possible if we only think of yeah, these budgets and like some 50K would do the job. Like, I mean, this is somewhat of an ordinary a documentary budget. But we're still far away from that, like from such a situation. I know that my Mark Saunders in London with Spectacle, that they are going down that road, and they are trying to play this role, but struggling hard. It's still not taking place. And as also Sandra said, this filmmaking effort is more seen as a benefit, like as an add-on, but in the end it might lead to some publication gap because the film is not recognized as publication, which is a mess, more than tricky, let's say. So yeah, lots of idealism, self-exploitation, and yeah, kind of stubbornness, I would say, to keep doing it, because I think times are changing. We're living in this visual age, and if social impact is supposed to mean anything, like if that has a value for research ambitions, then these two things should go together.
Thank you, Tino. I just wanted to open the floor, so to speak. If any of you want to say anything, or perhaps you have questions for each other, now we have a few minutes.
I had one for Sandra. I just wanted to say that I think what for me emerges out of this podcast is also the different approaches and the plurality of films in the realm of urban studies that are coming from geography, from ethnography, but also like different approaches, archival, ethnographic, or so on. But I think for me, Urban Lab has been a really hopeful space where you go and you see this mass of people really sort of converging to watch films and appreciate films, and you have kind of a formation somehow of some sort of funding sources, some coming together of different people into setting up some sort of curriculums, or coming up with like short courses on filmmaking and so on. So I just wanted to ask Sandra, because you've been involved there, could you like maybe share some experiences from Urban Lab, from inside the Urban Lab?
Yes, I'm happy to share some experiences. Well, one key fact is obviously there's a direct connection, because Matthew kind of set up the Urban Lab, and his interest in film is ongoing. He's been writing about film a lot, but he's also, before Natura Urbana, he's made a shorter documentary film called Liquid City about Mumbai. So I think he really tried to kick this off, and there's a bunch of scholars there, and PhD students, postdocs, etc., who are interested in both, in film screenings and discussing films, and also in making films, so that you have these connections across different fields, including film studies, which is an obvious field to bring in. And then when I started, we had a geography film group, and we basically watched one film per week in a small room, and just had a bag of crisps and chatted about the film. So that was really nice. And it had, over the years now, it has evolved also through the directorship of Ben Kempkin, who kind of taking over from Matthew the Urban Lab for some years. He's now stepped down again into this kind of big collaboration also with the local cinema, the Curzon, with film screenings. I'd love to see this happen in Berlin. So I'll try to kind of put some effort into maybe working across cinema and the university, because locally here we have such great networks still of cinemas and people working in film. Berlin has a long tradition in that field as well. So I'd love to see more happening around film and the urban here at the Humboldt and beyond.
Okay, and Tino, it's the last word is for you.
Oh my God. I don't know if I can say something promising, like since I am torn apart between these two worlds, science and the film world. And I always have this impression for science I'm too arty, and for film I'm too academic. Even though I would always think the bottom line is academic or well researched, but like how to really make sense, how to really bring this together, this is an art. Like how to do this, as we all know, we saw, or we can see, hopefully, like Nitin's premiere in April soon. It's a wonderful film. I have seen it. Like I don't know if the premiere is set already, but like that's definitely a wonderful film. I recommend Sandra's film as well. And invite everybody like to watch How Poles Became White.
Okay, wonderful. Nitin, Sandra, Tino, thank you very much for being with us today. I think this episode really raised the relevance of filmmaking for urban studies, and it certainly whetted my appetite for watching more of these emerging films. And we will post several of your recommendations in the show notes for our listeners to watch at a later moment. So thank you all very much.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter